The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. Let me say a few things. I'm going to preface what I'm going to do today with a few general considerations. First of all, this year, probably for the first 6 months of 2012, today is January 13th, 2012, my radio shows will be happening, but they'll be a bit more sporadic than they have been in the past. Number two, and the reason for this is that I am engaged in a substantial research project. And like a lot of the things I end up doing, they're never really planned. They come together because certain strands of research begin to converge. What I'm doing is a three-volume work of philosophy. I'm doing the concept of subornopravna, the concept of the logos as a structure of all reality, both physical and mental and social and spiritual, as it has manifested itself in Greek, patristic, Russian, and Ukrainian philosophy. It's never been done before. It's never been done before in English or in any other language. And it's a huge project. And the three volumes will be Greek, patristic, the first few hundred years after Christ, and the Greek philosophical writers like Basil and Simeon, who adapted the faith to at least certain elements of Greek philosophy simply as a way to explicate it to others who don't understand. And then the second would be the Ukrainian tradition, starting with Cyril of Turov in Belarus, and throughout the Ukrainian philosophical vision up until the 20th century. And then finally, the Russian tradition, which in my case is mostly late 19th century, early 20th century, really early and late 20th, all the way up to the 1980s. And so it's three volumes and a huge amount of research, a lot of which I have done. I have a very rough draft of the Greek and the Ukrainian volume, and I have a rough draft, although only in writing, of the Russian volume. I mean, writing on paper, not typed into a word processor. And this is taking a huge amount of time, and I require a certain amount of money. Now, that's the last thing I want to talk about. I don't ask for donations, and almost everybody who does this kind of thing asks for donations, but I'm going to change that. I hate asking for money. I hate talking about money. I hate what money does to people. And I hate how money perverts the mentality and the thought process of otherwise rational human beings. But I have to. And I have to do it because, unlike many of my colleagues, I do not have huge corporate foundations giving me money. I do not have huge, profoundly corrupt universities giving me money. I do not have wealthy churches, whether it be the Roman Church or the larger Orthodox churches like the OCA and the Antiochians, who have large amounts of money, both from their members, their bishops, as well as certain foundations like the World Council of Churches that give money to these kind of more liberal institutions. And so that's how they could, they're relatively small in numbers, and yet they can maintain fairly substantial institutions, which of course is very suspicious in my book. My Metropolitan John of New York and New Jersey, who is the head of the Western Rite Orthodox Church in America, in communion with the Greeks under Angelos, the Bulgarians under Gudovasi, the Russians under Raphael of Moscow, and the Ukrainians under Unufiri of Bukovina. And so we form a large church. We form the largest true Orthodox church in the world. We have roughly 600, 700 parishes and about 5,000 monastics. So we're a very large institution, and yet my metropolitan here in America lives in deliberate poverty. He lives in poverty because he is, I think he's a holy man, a saintly man, and I think he is protesting the mentality of so many religious figures who make an awful lot of money promoting their particular religious view. And the result of it is that sensitive people become very cynical as to the whole thing. And so my metropolitan lives in poverty in the mountains of northern New Jersey, often without heat. And he does this while taking care of several sick, physically sick monks. And so it's a tremendous strain on him. He's the man who ordained me and is my spiritual father and was really my main professor since 04 in Western Rite and medieval theology and liturgics, which prior to then, the Western Rite liturgy in the Orthodox sense of that word, the early medieval Western or Old Roman liturgy, I didn't know much about. I knew the Roman liturgy from Trent to the advent of the Novus Ordo. But prior to that, I didn't realize how intense the differences were in the priestism or the the first millennium Western Orthodox Rite, the Old Roman Rite. Some people call it the Sarum Rite. It has many names, but is the Roman Rite as used in Germany, in Northern Europe in general, in Britain, and in Western Europe in general terms, and as it illegitimately, in my opinion, displaced the Mozarabic and the Gallican rites, which were heavily Greek in origin. And he spent his life translating the early medieval documents from Britain and resurrecting the ancient liturgical forms of the Western Rite and the Old Roman Rite, largely now lost. And we're the only group on the planet that is doing the ancient liturgy, which derives from the 9th century York Missal, Northumbria, among other places, but that's the main one. And so it's not as if I have a bishop who is a multimillionaire. I know that Philip Saliba of the Antiochians, by his own admission, is a multimillionaire, which is completely non-canonical. Bishops are supposed to be monks, and monks are not supposed to own anything in their own accord. And so my bishop is, regardless of what you may think of different things religiously that we do and what we're all about, my bishop lives in complete poverty by his own choice, as in a part of his ascetic lifestyle, but also as a protest against the wealthy Christian fakers out there. So I am going to ask for donations. I am going to put my PayPal email account on my program page. So as you're hearing this, it will be there. I can swear to you that any money that you send to me will be used either for my research agenda, which always has to be funded, my church, my Orthodox church that I have here and that I pastor and liturgize within, and the various expenses that come with that. I want you guys to know, and I don't think I've ever said this before, but I refuse to accept any tax-exempt status as a priest and canon and also as having a church. I do not ask for tax exemption. I pay all my taxes just like any other person, and I refuse to go to the IRS, because when you get the tax-exempt status from the IRS, you, number one, cannot deal in politics. You might be able to talk about broader philosophical issues of justice and stuff like that, but you cannot publicly use a tax-exempt church for political or that kind of social preaching. You could lose your tax-exempt status for that reason, at least if it's a Christian church. I know the synagogues are tax-exempt, and they are strictly political, and no one seems to say anything about that. but at least for Christians, it's something that you have to be very careful about. And number two, it also brings you very closely under government regulation, and you have to follow many guidelines in terms of how the church is designed and laid out, and you have to consistently update that information with the IRS. So I do not take any tax-exempt statuses in my life here. And so as much as I hate to do it, all of these things require me to ask for money. For the first time in my career, I've had to ask for money and for donations to my PayPal account. And like I say, all of this will go to one of those two things without question. The money I get from my books, which I sell, which isn't all that much, usually I spend that on assisting Father Brendan, who is a very, very sick, disabled monk at the Abbey of the Holy Name, where my metropolitan is bishop and abbot. And because he always needs different things, I buy him whatever he needs, and I take the money from the sale of those books. So generally speaking, I don't see any money from the book sales. So I ask you to do that in all humility. I hate asking and even talking about it, but it's something that I require given this research project. So all you need to do is just use my PayPal email, and you could send things that way, and that's really the best way to do it. If you wanted to send a donation in some other way, email me and the Yahoo account and ask me, and we could come to some kind of arrangement. And I really appreciate anybody who's considering it. But at the very least, you know that if you're interested in these kinds of projects in this radio show, you can help in a small amount to keep it on and keep it independent, because it's always a struggle when you do not have the big institutions and the big universities financing your work. So I get to remain independent, and I get to maintain my integrity and speak precisely what I believe in my field. And my colleagues who are doing much better financially, in my opinion, are not doing well professionally, because they get promoted and they get tenure and they get to go to the DC think tanks. And yet we all know, and I know from experience, that you cannot say what you feel. You have to toe the line, and you have to promote the agenda of whatever organization is giving you money. Now, today, we're going to talk about a writer, a Russian writer who dies in 1885, one of the founders of the modern Pan-Slavic movement, Nikolai Danilevsky. Danilevsky is a secular man for the most part. He approaches political science and history as Aristotle did, as a biologist. He is a strong critic of Charles Darwin from a secular point of view. His writings were overwhelmingly secular and scientific relative to the rise and fall of civilization, which was his main purpose and was his main area of focus in all of his work. He's most famous for the book Russia in Europe, where he tried to take some Slavophile doctrine and apply it to Russia as not an empire, not a nation, but as a civilization in its own right. And lots of Danilevsky's insights were taken by Sam Huntington in his Clash of Civilizations book and the general thesis that he's promoted there. I don't remember whether Danilevsky gets credit for a lot of the things that Huntington took from him, but as you'll see here in a minute, Danilevsky lays out a concept of civilization and how to understand and analyze a civilization as it rises and falls, which in certain respects is identical to what Samuel Huntington will much later write in his Clash of Civilizations. Danilevsky does not believe in any kind of racial or civilizational supremacy. He doesn't believe in any kind of Russian messianic approach to history. And he believes in this for a very specific reason. that one of his theses that he bases his writing on is that all civilizations are unique. And therefore, in any real important way, there is no vocabulary that you can use to compare and contrast civilizations as they are born, rise, and fall. And this is because the context under which and within which a civilization comes into existence are always different. Their problems are different. The climate is different. The way of life ends up being very different. And therefore, it's very hard to try and compare civilizations over time. The only way to study history is to take these political, social, civilizational entities and understand first and foremost how they understood themselves from their own point of view. And I've said on this show before that I've gotten into an awful lot of trouble over the years taking that point of view. One of the reasons I lost my teaching job at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg is that I insisted when I dealt with the Third Reich or the Second Reich in Germany or the Japanese Empire or Tsarist Russia, is that I demanded that students understand these entities not as the textbooks describe them, not as the system describes them, not as the academic establishment describes them, but as they described themselves. And it doesn't seem like a big deal, but when you approach history that way, it changes everything. The point is that you're trying to see a civilization that its leaders and intellectuals, how have they understood it? You're looking at a civilization from their point of view. What did they think they were doing? What did they think they were contributing to the world, and in what context? That is the only way you could understand civilization. For Danielewski, a civilization is a type of life. It's far broader than any quantitative measures like the money in circulation or the nature of the banking system or the nature of the farming system. That's not it. The quantitative issues have their place. But a civilization is an entity of entities. It is what Eric Vogelin would call the cosmion. It is the organization of life and thought according to one or several basic principles. And the fact is that civilizations differ. That is a radical concept in academia because the historical establishment holds that all entities, be economic or political or social or national, are comparable one to another. And they usually reduce everything to an economic or functionalist analysis and quantifies everything, and it comes off as very superficial. They may try to compare, let's say, urban infrastructure, you know, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Japanese shogunate, and without understanding how these different civilizations understood something like urban infrastructure. The fact is that an area specialist, someone who focuses on one of these areas, is going to be able to, in great detail, explain how they viewed those kind of issues and what they thought they were doing. And if you get deep into a specific area, you begin to realize that you just can't use these superficial quantitative methods to compare institutions when those institutions are embedded in different civilizations. They are understood differently. Their similarities are largely superficial. And in the academic establishment, what you want to do is reduce everything to dollars and cents or to a certain kind of military strength or whatever the quantitative issue is. Reduce everything to that. And then from that analysis, assume that everyone's the same. And really, that's the attack on nationalism. Danielewski is not a nationalist because a civilization is far larger than a nation. It contains a nation. A nation is a cultural entity, is at the root of it. But only from that does a civilization derive. Many of you know Oswald Spengler, and of course Danilevsky was very, very significant in Spengler, extremely significant, in fact, and Spengler cited Danilevsky all the time. The big issue is that there's a big difference between a culture, a way of life, what Danilevsky will call the ethnic stage of civilizational development, and what later becomes that broader, larger civilization. And Spengler and Danilevsky differ in the sense that a civilization is not a flowering of anything. A civilization is, in fact, the stagnation and regression of the healthy, virile ethnic culture of a people. That is one huge area, sort of this meta-historical, methodological issue, where I agree fully with Spengler. He's absolutely correct. A civilization grows out of a specific ethnic culture, and what happens is that the qualitative, affective, aesthetic elements in ethnicity slowly become bureaucratized and quantified and formalized in the coercive and economic apparatus of a civilization. That's a huge change. That explains so much in historical science. And it's going to get you into a lot of trouble in the academic establishment because it forces you not to look at history, especially 20th century history, as this moral drama between the wonderful cosmopolitan liberals in America and Britain on the one hand and the evil nationalists and empire builders on the other. I shouldn't say empire builders because Britain is a leader of this kind of cosmopolitan idea and was the greatest empire builder. What I mean is that there's this white and black hat morality play that takes place in historical science today, and you have these great liberal cosmopolitans on the one side and the nationalists and fanatics on the other side. And that's how they view everything. And they take that kind of absurd, you know, simplified, facile kind of view and impose it on whatever it is and whatever it is they see. So when I went into the classroom and I spent several days on Rosenberg's Myth of the 20th Century, it was not long after that, in fact, a few days after that, that I was removed. And that I can't possibly be a coincidence. And I said that the Myth of the 20th Century is probably the best book for understanding how the Third Reich understood itself. What did it think it was doing? And of course, approaching history that way is going to get you into a lot of trouble because it avoids this requisite demand that you insist that history is just this morality play. And everything in historical science from the prehistoric to the contemporary world existed to bring forth the American middle class liberal bourgeoisie. And everything in history has that final end. And for all their pseudoscience, pretending that there is no absolute truth, pretending that there is no purpose to history or nature, when push comes to shove, they're extremely dogmatic in that global history is just one big machine that leads to modern, liberal, acultural cosmopolitanism and oligarchy. And that's what the historical process is to do, and they call that liberty or freedom or something like that, modernity. All right, we're going to get deeper into Nikolai Danilevsky when we return. Hang in there.
Don't go away because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, Reason Radio Network. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Hey, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about the historical and social philosophy of Nikolai Danilevsky. I said in the first part of the show that I'm working on a 3-volume book on patristic Ukrainian and Russian philosophy as it relates to the concepts of subordinos, subunoprawna, and logos, and these doctrines that we have dealt with on the show. And it's something that just kind of came together that I wasn't planning. And I have a rough draft of much of this material. It's going to be a substantial piece of work. And it's really going to be the synthesis of everything that I've spent the last 20 years worrying about. And Danilevsky is going to be a chapter in the Russian philosophical section. You can summarize his philosophy of history in 5 laws of historical work. 5 laws of approaching history as a writer and a philosopher lies at the root of everything that he takes to be important. Number 1, as we said before, no 2 civilizations are alike. I'm not going to go so far as to say that they're incomparable, but that comparison has to be done with a great amount of trepidation. There really is no absolute category that you can use to perfectly compare 2 civilizations. They're simply too different, and this quantitative method that a historian will use today is superficial. It doesn't get to the root of the matter. Number 2, the development of any people, and of course, not every people is going to become a civilization. There's really only a few of them. But the development of a people requires political independence. Political independence is necessary for the native genius of any people to reach its potential. Civilizations and ethnic groups are basically equal, not in the sense that they are identical in some important moral way, but because there's really no way to compare them. You can't compare, let's say, 20th century Western Europe that centered itself around materialism and the scientific method, so to speak, and say that Western Europeans must be far superior to those in South Asia, because those in South Asia had not developed this level of technology. That's a stupid thing to say, because the assumption is that all civilizations are supposed to develop what moderns call technology. But that's a wild and ludicrous assumption. And that's all it is an assumption. Civilizations have an internal motor of how it generates ideas and concepts about itself, and that they're unique. And they have different priorities and different motives relative to their historical context. Number 3, ideas that develop in the context of one civilization are almost impossible to impose on another one. And that's extremely relevant for today and the neocon regime's desire to impose democracy on the world. And democracy is a code word for many, many ideological assumptions. Number 4 is really the question about nationalism, that the stage of civilization, as opposed to the earlier kind of culture or ethnic group, it's reached when the different subgroups, the sub-ethnicities within the society are assimilated. So, for example, when Rome developed its republic, it slowly assimilated the tribal organizations in central Italy, like the Latins and others. That is one of the marks, one of the quantitative marks that show when a ethnic society is making that very important shift to the civilizational stage. And finally, the civilizational type comes into existence only once. They exist one time, they are unique, and yet even when the civilization is gone, the insight generated by that civilization continues to endure. It can be assimilated into another civilization, but it will be changed fairly substantially in the process. So Russia received its Orthodox religion from Byzantium and the Greeks in the Empire of Constantinople. And yet, although the doctrines are exactly the same, how this religion was made a part of Russian life created two very different churches. Two very different churches with the exact same basic doctrinal foundation. And from that point of view, at least in the Orthodox world, the concept of autocephaly arises because autocephaly admits that different peoples are going to assimilate the exact same faith very differently. And therefore, the linguistic way, and I say the word language and linguistic in a very general sense, not just about words, but about an entire thought about life, that different languages require their own internalized church administration. So it's one faith manifest in very different ways over the centuries. So that's a simple example. The Orthodox faith had its origin in the Greek world, transferred itself to Russia via Greek bishops, and although the doctrine remains the same, the church became Russianized. It became a Russian institution, and so there's a lot of things that are emphasized in the Russian church that are not emphasized in the Greek church or the Serbian. So, yeah, I mean, I know I said before that ideas can't transfer. They can't. The only way that an idea can be absorbed and assimilated by another civilization is if they take it apart and then put it back together again from their point of view. And that happens quite a bit. So the way that we grasp a civilization and the way that we try to understand one is to understand them religiously, scientifically, artistically, politically, and economically. Those are very general variables that you could use to analyze any society. And when you focus on one, you'll realize that they understand these concepts very differently in one place than they do another. And you believe that there's this single universal man in direct proportion to your lack of knowledge on the subject. Only when you get deep into a group of people, like I have with the Russian and Ukrainian, you know, like so many other, you know, David Irving with the German in the 20th century, you get deep into this stuff and you start reading so many essays and letters from the elites of the society, you begin to realize that in very nuanced but very important ways, they define the purpose and the function and the general concept of all of these things, like art and science, completely differently from one place to another. Now, his main book, the book that he's known for, is Russia and Europe. Each civilization here, it sets its own standard. There's really a three-variable move that an ethnic group, a culture, in Spengler's sense, develops its own state, it develops its own external outer coating, the independence that's required, according to Danilevsky, for a civilization to come into existence. And from that independent state, and he's using the state like he uses all of these variables very generally, very vaguely. We use the same word only for convenience, even though the state, as it developed in Imperial Russia, was completely different than the state as it developed in Persia. And that's the institution that will eventually create civilization. Remember, not all ethnic groups, of which there are tens of thousands throughout global history, will attain civilizational status. Most will not. Most will find their survival either in cooperating with a dominant local power or by assimilating completely with the dominant local power, as you saw in Rome in the beginning of the Republic. And the local central Italian tribes eventually just kind of disintegrated and intermarried within this basic Roman ethnos that created a non-Greek Roman society. This movement, culture to state to civilization, hierarchy, social discipline, is absolutely necessary to go from one to the other. And civilization is the final stage, but it's far from certain that it is the best stage, that it's the stage that all societies tend to go. Civilization is what happens when an ethnic group gets its own state and independence and becomes extremely significant politically and culturally and religiously for all those in their general vicinity. It becomes more than a nation because its influence and power, I don't necessarily even mean coercive power, any kind of influence that it may have begins to affect and integrate the mentality of ethnic groups around it. You know, again, Rome is a clear and classic example of how you can become Romanized without actually being Roman. As far as Russia and Europe is concerned, both the book and the idea, the civilizational context, which makes Russia, number one, a civilization in and of itself, and number two, separate from Western Europe, is its origin. Russia takes its basic social and religious concept, in general terms, from Byzantium and from the Greek Empire in Constantinople. And that old Rome, that the Rome in Italy, becoming the center of Western Europe, then informs the British and the Germans and the Spanish and the French. So from those two original cities, Rome on the one hand, Byzantium on the other, Old Rome or New Rome, you develop two overarching and yet very different civilizations. So, of course, Danilevsky is going to say that Westernization is an error. That if Russia is going to borrow certain things, let's say like, the scientific method from the British, they're going to Russify it. They're going to take this idea because it's good and useful, and they are going to give it their own characteristics and contextualize it within their own life. So they're the same idea, only superficially. So he holds that the fact that Russia comes from Byzantium, Western Europe comes from Rome, in general terms, creates two incomparable civilizations. And in very general terms, he follows the old Slavophile concept, because he's a generation now after the Slavophile movement in the 1840s, that Western Europe develops a concept. Its civilizational markers are the notion of external power and external law, external logic dominating everything rather than internal coherence. Big difference. The fact that the Western Roman Empire collapsed and created a huge power vacuum that the German tribes had to cope with created a totally different political entity than in Eastern Europe, where the Roman Empire did not collapse. It maintained its existence until 1453, and by then, the Slavic world, anyway, had largely settled in its basic civilizational type. The fact that Russia never went through, at least in the Western sense, a Reformation, a Renaissance in the Italian sense, never went through the Enlightenment in the British or French sense. It never had those historical epics and struggles. Of course, the result is that Russian civilization based in Moscow, not St. Petersburg, the Russian civilization based in Moscow and Kiev are very, very different concepts from Western European civilization based in Rome, London, or Berlin. Another example that he uses is that Western Europe was so powerfully defined in the early Middle Ages that we've dealt with on this show, on the clash culturally and linguistically between the German tribes on the one hand and the Gallo-Romans in France, for example, on the other. That constant back and forth ethnically, that constant struggle, the creation of feudalism, which he says, at least to some extent, comes out of that struggle. The Norman idea, and they invaded Britain in 1066. These are quintessentially Western European concepts coming from this clash of Roman and German, something which has no applicability to Russia, who did not have that kind of consistent and defining ethnic clash and eventually ethnic accommodation. They may have had it in northern Russia in the Middle Ages, but even there, it did not come to define the Russian character like it did the feudal age in Western Europe. These are the ingredients that went on to create two very different groups of people, the Western European idea and the Russian idea, two civilizations, two globally elite civilizations, both who have their tremendous virtues and their extraordinary vices, but given how they understand each other, you can't compare them. Both have their sets of problems that come from the civilizational type that they have chosen or that history has given them. You can't compare, for example, if you were to say that Western Europe is superior because of its extraordinary technological apparatus, because, first of all, there's no scientific reason to believe that every society should want to develop that kind of technology. And number two, that the technological apparatus of Western Europe didn't cause as many problems as it solved. One way or the other, the fact is that Danileschi is very insistent that you cannot compare or contrast civilizations. You have to understand them on their own terms. And when you do use a set of concepts to compare different civilizations, you have to be very careful that when you use the same word like state or right or science, when you compare two different civilizations, you use those words, you have to make it clear in your writing that we're using this superficially, because we realize that these concepts, as they've been assimilated by these civilizational types, developed very differently and in very different directions, and that's what makes them incomparable. Danileschi is known less for his critique of Charles Darwin than he is for Russia and Europe. His critique of Darwin is curious largely because Danileschi was a secular man, heavily influenced by biology as it was developing in the rationalist systems of Western Europe, and thought that in a limited way, that method can be used. And like everything else, it will eventually take on very Russian characteristics and become a Russian thing, even though its origin is foreign. So Danileschi, in his critique of Darwin, provides a secular, to some extent, a secular and imperial critique of Darwinism as it relates to his theory. The problem that Danileschi has is that he doesn't believe that there's any such thing as a scientific theory, in the sense that a scientific theory is this very broad set of axioms and arguments that can be applied to a large number of subjects. You know, evolution is clearly in that category. That those things can never be separated from the social origin and the ethnic origin that created them. And Danileschi says that there is nothing more British than the theory of evolution, and that the similarities between a British capitalist and imperialist interests and the concepts used by Darwin to describe struggle in nature, they are too similar to be coincidental. Outside of that, the fact that science derives from the ethnic context, not from just this pure and unadulterated reason, which in Danileschi does not exist, it can't exist. Reason always has to be contextualized. It has to be about something. The problem that Danileschi also has with Darwin is that he thinks that Darwin overstresses the idea of competition. Darwin writes his book dead center in the middle of the British Industrial Revolution. And the fact that the capitalist system is based on this constant expansion, governments and economic entities constantly in competition, looking for a leg up on their opponents, this is the classic British imperial point of view. And that British capital and the British Empire can be very conveniently justified with the Darwinian theory, because the British, due to their genetic makeup and the struggles that they've been through over their national existence position themselves to become the first great industrial power. And that gave the British that extra ingredient in their existence that made it possible for them to dominate so many other parts of the world. The connection between Darwin's theory and the interests of the British Empire are so close that it seems almost to be absurd. But more significantly, in terms of the theory itself, Danilewski's view is that survival of the fittest is a problem. It's a problem not just because it derives from British capitalist civilization. And of course, as most of you know, Herbert Spencer later on in Britain will take Darwin and explicitly apply it to British capitalism. And it was Spencer, not Darwin, that popularized the theory in scientific circles, because he went to the economic elite first rather than the scientific establishment. But Danilewski's problem is foundational in the sense that he thinks Darwin stresses competition and forgets about the significance of cooperation. And then he makes what I think is the intriguing statement that survival is based as much on conservation, if not more so, than it does change. Coherence and conservation of that coherence of not just the organism, but its immediate surroundings is more important than competition for understanding the natural world and also for understanding the social world. Ultimately, Danilewski's critique of Darwin is that you can't reduce natural types to the results of constant struggle or a struggle in general without destroying those organisms. And of course, he makes a very common argument, one that I have some sympathy with, that one of the big scientific and metaphysical problems of evolutionism is that it treats organisms in isolation rather than the reality that organisms are constantly embedded in a cooperative ecosystem. Therefore, if X changes, then A, B, C, D, and E always then not only have to change as well, but they have to lay the groundwork for the possibility of the change to be accepted within the system. So Danilewski says that when you think of the natural world and a social world as a system of constantly mutually interacting entities that seek above all coherence and unity, and hence conservation, you end up with a very different philosophy of science. I don't want to say that someone like Darwin took organisms in isolation. He didn't. Everything with him was relational. And yet Danilewski's point of view is that each and every significant quality in an organism exists not only because of itself, but because of how it fits in with everything else around it, the entire ecosystem, and all of the laws and forces that come to create its coherence and conservation. And in Orthodox theology, the word is logos. That is the Platonic form of the natural order that is embedded within ecosystems, and of course ecosystems within and around ecosystems, to create the entire cosmic order, which is one single system. Therefore, a change in one area has to be accepted and permitted by every other actor in the system, especially those immediately surrounding it. So just as Darwin was tightly connected with British economic and political power in the world in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, Danilewski is claiming that not only do the scientific theories in general, I mean, not just evolution, but any of these macro theories, not only are they civilizationally based, that they're based on civilizational interests and concepts and their historical struggles, not on naked reason. He's not just making that claim, which is common enough. He's also making the claim that the primary reason that any entity in the social or economic or in the natural worlds which for him were, you know, three sides of the same coin, three sides of the same triangle, I should say. They're really the same entity, just seen from different points of view. It's cooperation and cohesion, which are the primary ingredients. Therefore, you clearly see how he wants to create a new concept of the philosophy of science, to create a new concept where the increasing integration and unity, not of a thing or an organism, but the community as a whole, the ecosystem as a whole, that is the object of science, not the organism. And when you think of it from that point of view, not only does it make sense out of his civilizational and national concept, but it provides a very different foundation for scientific work, whether that be economic, social sciences, or the natural sciences. And that's a big deal for him. And it's something that is a meta theory that makes sense out of his critique of Darwin on the one hand, and his understanding of the civilizational concept on the other. Of course, being Russian, his primary concern was to explicate what it is to be part of Russian civilization and how concepts that we take for granted, like the scientific method and moral virtue and community and things like that, state, authority, sovereignty, that these are always contextualized. And they're contextualized in Russia with a very specific set of unrepeatable variables. The Orthodox Church, at that time in its development in the 9th century, the Empire of Byzantium, the politics and economics of the Balkans, the gathering of the Russian lands in Moscow, etc., etc., etc. And that these then create a very different kind of civilization. Okay, I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
To Radio Aryan.